accession number 22658, reel 16.
This would have been, and I understand, the sort of McCarthy policy of hitting them where they ain't and island hopping and those sorts of things. What was the feeling of heading off again when the war was pretty well over in Europe? Had you sort of gotten to the point where you were sick of being taken off? Possibly
no,
to not really do much?
Yeah. But we sort of realised that there was only one thing to do, was ultimately to get to Japan, in which this was all the staging plan was the basis of that. So we were basically working on the ideas that, you know, we'd be just following on or endeavouring to successfully undertake each of the stages as we were required. But what did happen that we were sent away away from the direct approach to the Philippines, offering to the Borneo Dutch areas, where there's, when you take, for example, there's something like 20,000 in the Tapas Valley of Japanese that were there, and that was only, well, I mean, that's the equivalent of a division, and that was only one space, and they were in other areas and probably smaller groups and things like that.
People talk about this whole action as really one that didn't necessarily have to involve any Australian troops.
Yeah.
They could have just been left there.
Well, that was a general opinion. I mean, you could have just left them there, let the Navy and the Air Force split up any supply lines or things of that nature and just starve them out. That would have been the ideal thing, but I suppose the powers that be had to do something with us. I mean, the Australian troops were part of the overall plan, and of course in my opinion, and a lot of others' opinions, MacArthur didn't want anybody else but Americans in the final approach to the Philippines and ultimately Japan. I mean, although we had Mountbatten, I don't think it was one of them, Duke of Gloucester, came in to inspect us on Labian Island and things like that. Anything to do with the British would terminate in Singapore, or any British possessions, like the Borneo situation. I don't think he didn't want any of those, though he did use the Australian Air Force and Navy, but only in specialised areas.
Were you aware of this sort of situation at the time?
Oh, well, we knew that Blamey, MacArthur and and others weren't in, let's say, in a friendly situation. And
what then was the general opinion of the average soldier about going off and heading into Borneo, do you think, at the time?
Well, I think it, you know, they probably all spoke about it as, you know, considered it useless, but the point was that we had to go and that was it.
There was.
So if you want to go around smoking a cigarette at night time, you might as well write yourself off. But that was the general situation that, well, we had a job to do, and that was it. If we didn't do it properly, well, we wouldn't come back. And that would be it, and we're on a winning roll sort of business, but, you know, people are still getting killed.
Mm. Well, I would assume that that would be a main concern, that, yeah, you know, you've gotten this far, you've seen everything, and now it's almost at the end.
Yes, well, it, of course, the other thing that would, our particular battery, and that we hadn't been really in the jungle, and when we got into the into Borneo, we knew what the situation was, and we could realise what the fellows had from the Kokoda Trail right through up into Wildebeest, or the area around that, where I think 6DIV was involved in.
So you realised what they'd had to put
what they had to put up with.
And can you then describe to us your situation on your arrival in Borneo and what you ended up doing?
Well, we moved across from Labian to Western. That was a part of British North Borneo. That was a little coastal town, and it was all in the plantation, rubber plantation area. Though you had the coastal strip, and then you had the rising ground getting into, I call them mountains and things, but they're high, quite high hills and things like that, and valleys. But around from Western to Beaufort was the railway line, which was just, I don't know whether it was a 3'6" gauge or not, just a minor railway line, which the plant is used for the transportation of their rubber down to Western or to Beaufort, and it then would go across to Labian Island and be shipped off from there. But what had happened after we'd finished all our labouring forces and things on Labian, we then became reserve infantry for the 9DIV groups that were in Borneo at the time. They were well behind the actual fighting, but in between where the fighting was, there were stray Japs and things of that nature, who half of them were starving sort of business, so you didn't know. And they would they'd be somewhere around, that's if you could find them, and hopefully that they might be able to get some of the food that might have been left from the cooking areas of wherever the troops might be. But of course we were gradually getting into the thicker jungle and things, and of course we weren't very happy about the sleeping situations with mosquito nets and things of that nature, because you could imagine being wrapped up in a mosquito net and somebody, some Jap, which they were doing was on a pole, of thin pole, strong pole, with a bayonet or a knife or something like that, and just trying to kill you at night time sort of business. Then if you had a rifle, that had to be close by. You didn't want it sleeping in your hammock sort of business. Or if you had a pistol or something like that, it'd be a bit easier. But it was just that, irrespective of what it may be, you had to get out of that mosquito net and really just protect yourself. Of course, I've often said that at night time that I'd do 6 months in the desert to 1 month in the jungle, mainly because of the noise, leaves falling down through the trees, monkeys scampering around the place, pigs coming in to where food had been prepared and things like that. And of course you had booby traps all around the place, and of course if one of those went off, well, you're all up. And if you had somebody that was trigger happy, you'd one shot and you'd be awake.
So you're always on edge.
Yeah, on edge. And of course, then if you're on patrols, and we used to do, we didn't do many, but they were 2 and 3 days out. And of course, you had to sleep out in the open and things like that, and you had to carry gear, so you had the lightest thing that you could do. And all you could do is get through a track, and there were these magnificent trees, 120 feet high, without a branch, up about 60 foot or something like that. Magnificent trees, and that, you know, and being, most of us had a fair bit of idea about timber and country life and things like that, and sort of comparing it with our own country, and that it was just unbelievable, the timber that was up in that. And were the places we went to. But getting back, you'd have your infantry practice, you know, with your scouts out the front and things of that nature. Of course, the usual trend was to let the scouts go through and cop the rest of coming through. But, you know, fortunately we didn't have any of those sort of situations, but you're on guard all the time, and then you've got the pigs, the animals. This is in daytime. There's movements in the bush and things like that.
What, did you have any contact with Japanese while you were there?
No, only when I personally know. That's in the battle area, but we did when, because Labyrinth became a prisoner of war camp sort of. Situation, the main base, and then.
Were you in contact with them when they were prisoners of war?
Yes, but I can go further in this situation because I was involved in surrender parties when we, after the surrender by the Japanese, I suppose we might have been a month or so still in that situation, because there were Japs that didn't know that the war had ended, and they were still in a warlike situation. They were hungry, and some of our own troop, they killed a few of them around the place. But I mean, I just don't beg your pardon if you saw one of it.
Just before we go to that, do you recall where you were when VE Day occurred on May the 8th?
I think, I wouldn't be 100% sure, but it would probably be around Labyrinth area.
Do you recall there being a special sort of occasion to celebrate the situation in Europe having come to a close?
I don't think so. I can't just, not like it was out on the desert, because it was Guy Fawkes Night when they broke through. So I don't think there was any firing or anything of that nature.
Given that you were still at war at that point,
yeah, well,
what was the feeling then of the fact that Europe had settled itself?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm talking hindsight now, would have been a great feeling that's the major area has been tidied up. Now they will get the Japs to contend with. That would be hindsight wise, that's what I would have been thinking about at the time, but we just carry on.
Do you recall then what it was like when you heard that the bombs had gone on, been dropped on Hiroshima on August the 6th and then Nagasaki on the 9th?
Well, obviously it was a surprise to us, and we just couldn't imagine atomic bombs and what the devastation will, and we didn't have an idea, but I mean, it was enough for them to throw the towel in, sort of a quick smart, no beg your pardons. And of course, the radio picked up a lot of information that was being passed around.
What was some of the information that you were hearing about that?
Well, it was just. I could only think that it would have been about, you know, what happened to the civilians and things like that, you know, just the charcoal situations. And
given the fact that you'd been a gunner and you'd seen what smaller bombs could do to things, how did you sort of envisage this big bomb destroying a city?
Just couldn't visualise it. I mean, you knew there were 1,000 pounders and might have been 3,000 or 4,000 pounders, so you can imagine what. You probably saw some photographs in the papers, because we did get. So your families would send you some papers, and though they'd be months old or something like that, that you could see the devastation of little Take Berlin and things like that. Well, you can imagine what atomic bomb would do. And you know, it would be the civilian part of it that would be horrific, with, you know, charred bodies all around the place. But,
given the fact that it had served its purpose, it had worked, it had stopped the war. What was the general feeling about that when that did happen? When the surrender came through on the
15th. Yeah, well, we all realised that it wasn't over. When I say over, we still had to be in a fighting situation, because, as I mentioned before, they didn't know it happened. if they operated the way we thought, they weren't going to throw the towel in themselves, and they'd prefer to die than go back home or be a prisoner of war.
So what was your experience then on the surrender parties?
Well, it was a bit difficult to give you a straight answer there, but if I... when we came back to Labuan, we... there were surrender parties being organised. When I say parties, and guards and things of that nature. and the other point is that in between after the surrender, the Japanese surrender, the army started to demobilise. And all 5 years, fellas that had been in the service 5 years, were pulled out, and they were sent home. Not by quotas, and I mean they were sent home on a quotas, and also what means of transport could take them back, you see. So and all those that were left behind were fellows like myself who were pretty close to 5 years, and they'd have to wait till their points were accumulated for you to be entitled to go. So that period we were all on Labian, and you could see the old hands going and going, and you said, when's my turn?
Yeah, what was the feeling then to see all these old mates going away?
Well, you know, it was pretty hard to take, because you know, we'd lived together for 5 years, and others, you know, 3 or 4 years, depending on how long they were caught up with the situation. But getting back, of course, Labian was a prisoner of war camp situation, and they had to be brought back, so we were bringing them back by ships and things wherever we possibly could. I mean, naturally they had to surrender. We didn't go out there and hunt them up and bring them back. But the other surrender parties were in certain areas where there was a proper ceremony. And, well, my first one was to go to a place called Tawaiyo, and that was on the border of Dutch New Guinea and British North on the east coast. Now, it's said that that was the first Japanese civilian colonisation on their behalf, so that there were civilians plus service personnel down there, and then there were army commanders and things down there that had to surrender. So we went on I don't know, say 20 or 30 of us with an officer to act as the guards for the surrender party and bring back these prisoners of war and the civilians.
Were you involved with the ceremony at all?
No, not directly. Not a part of it.
How did the Japanese deal with the fact that they lost?
Well, I can only speak in regards to Tawaiyo. Whoever was in charge, Japanese in charge, when we came onto the landing platform that was down there, which was a long boardwalk sort of situation leading out into the sea, and a place for sufficiently and safely moor a sizable vessel. Well, all their equipment was boxed up, all their weapons, you know, swords, rifles, binoculars, all neatly boxed up, and so whoever was in charge was a disciplined sort of a fellow and a tidy fellow. I believe there is a bullion there. There's a hell of a lot of stuff that would belong to the planters, particularly rifles and shotguns, overs and unders, and all those things. I mean, some of those guns that were there must be worth thousands and thousands of dollars in those days, because they were all pretty wealthy fellows. And they were already there for it to be taken aboard and taken back to wherever they're supposed to go. And then you had the soldiers and you had the civilians. And the civilians were riddled with beriberi, aged people. There weren't any kids that I knew of or saw. But, anyway.
Why were they in such a bad state?
Well, must have been short of supplies, and they had to live the best way they could. And because beriberi is a disease that if you haven't got the right vitamins and things of that nature, and probably had all sorts of gut problems. And so basically what happened after the surrender party, all these people had to be put on the LSD, and some of the civilians, they had their worldly possessions rolled up in a bag, like you've often seen on refugees, even in Afghanistan now. They're trying to cart this stuff. They couldn't. There's no hope in hell of them being able to carry it. That wasn't bulky stuff or anything like that. It was just they just were that weak that they couldn't carry them. And there were the soldiers there that wouldn't lend a hand to help them. So I was sort of heads to rag around the place. So they thought, we'll fix these blokes up. We just told them to do something, because naturally they didn't know what to do. So we gave them an exhibition what they had to do. So we made them cart all the gear on board for these people that were in dire straits. So eventually, there are other lots of things that you'd be here for hours if I told you.
You tell us a couple.
I was light on for a good pair of binoculars, and I found out where the box where they were stored. So I'm either prizing this thing open to get it, and I've got these glasses. They were field glasses, very small, and graduated. When I say field glasses, artillery field glasses, they graduated for the OPIPs to record their variations back to the guns and things of that nature. There's a line across like that and another one coming down there. And you could, wherever the shot fell, you could work it out for yourself how many degrees, whatever it was. So on board we had these academics who could speak Japanese or some of the other languages that may be available. I suppose that the one that picked me, I reckon he would have been about 20 or something. And he was going to have me slammed in the cooler because I was looting. And once again, he looked over his shoulder and the bloke standing next to me happened to be an officer. So once again I was saved. But those are the sorts of things. And then I was put in charge of, on board ship, of all the swords and the valuable rifles and all those sorts of things. So I made sure that anything that I reckon was value was hung up somewhere, so when I walked in, if someone pinched it, I know it was gone. And I went in there, and and I had the key, and stuff started to disappear. So I fronted up to the officer and I said, "You can, I'm not responsible for what goes on in there," even though I got myself a samurai sword and made a dinky die one, not a jeep spring made into one. So I said, "I know what goes on board the ship. There's master keys, and the crew's got the master keys, and they're knocking the stuff off." And in the end, it was decided we'd open the door and whatever you wanted to. But before that happened, one of the gunners came to me and he said, "Look, that double barrel shotgun up there," he said, "that's worth anything." And he said, "Well, I'd like it." I said, "Well, how are you going to get it home?" And he said, "I don't know." He said, "It won't fit in your kit bag." Well, I said, "I'll tell you how you can fit it in. You know the Bren gun case?" I said, "You can put it in that."